Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is Brazilian superstar Gilberto Gil. Gilberto?
Hi.
Great to have you here, or great to have me here. I am literally in Rio de Janeiro, yes, in the hills. Now, we Americans, not that everybody listening to this podcast lives in the United States, tend to be ignorant of other countries. So it's great to come to Brazil to see the topography. And the other thing is, I was asking whether they had daylight savings time in Rio de Janeiro, where they turn the clocks forward. And my driver said, oh, of course we have that. It ended in February. I was too stupid to realize everything's reversed. They had summer. Now we're going to fall.
So you're behind there.
Right. I'm here,
on
a beautiful fall day in the hills of Rio de Janeiro, where Gilberto has an office complex and a studio, and it very much reminds me of a fall day in Los Angeles. Certain mood, certain light, certain smell, and it has me in a mood, and I'm learning so much, and we're going to learn some more from Gilberto. So, Gilberto, when did you decide you wanted to make music for a living?
I was very young. My mother used to tell me a story about when I was two years of age, and she asked me what I was going to be when I grown up, and I responded, I answered, a musician. And then she took that in mind, and then she was always watching me. And then when at the age of nine, she sent me to a music school.
Okay, but you're at age two. What did your father do for a living? What did he do for work?
Doctor.
He was a doctor. What kind of doctor?
He was a physician.
Okay, so in America, that's a North America, because we're in America here too.
Yeah, yeah.
North America, a doctor is a upper middle class profession. The same thing here is good. There was enough money growing up, et cetera.
Yeah, he was an upper middle class person by the standards, by Bahia, Brazil and Bahia standards then, in 1939, when he graduated, and then he went to the countryside in Bahia to start his profession.
Okay, don't forget, I'm an American, so I'm ignorant. If I'm in Rio de Janeiro, where is Bahia?
Bahia, same Atlantic coast, north, going north. So if you consider the whole Atlantic Brazilian coast going from south to Amazon,
right?
Bahia is in the middle.
Okay, and how far is it from Rio de Janeiro?
2,500 kilometers.
Kilometers.
Yeah.
So that's 0.6, so that's like 1,200 miles. That's far.
It's far.
And is Bahia's...
But Brazil is huge.
Yeah, that's what people don't realize. You look at a map, most of South America is Brazil. It's the same size as the continental United States.
Yeah,
basically. So it was Bahia a big city?
Salvador, the founding city of Brazil, you know, when the Portuguese arrived,
right,
in 1500,
mm-hmm,
they spotted an interesting place to have the boats and everything, to, you know, the bay.
Right.
Salvador is a bay. Like Guanabara here in Rio is also a bay. So it's a beautiful bay where the Portuguese arrived and then installed themselves there. And they started the city. And that's the city of Salvador, the capital, actual capital of the state of Bahia. And then a historical city, you know, was the first one, you know.
So it predates Rio.
Yeah.
Came before. Okay, so you're 2 years old. Did your parents play a lot of music in the house?
No, not at all.
You just woke up one day, so I'm going to be a musician.
Yeah, it came from the radio. From listening to the radio. The radio was the only thing we had.
Well, the funny thing is, for those of us of a certain age, radio was still the thing. I remember living in Connecticut, and you'd get a transistor radio, and you'd put it under your pillow, and you listen to the baseball game. And then the Beatles hit, and you listen to music.
And music and football here in Brazil.
Exactly.
In Ituaçu, the little village in the countryside where my father went with his
wife. Okay, so how many children in your family?
Two. Me and a girl.
And are you the oldest? Or the
oldest. The 1 year older.
And is your sister still alive?
She's alive.
And what
the parents gone.
Right, but
my
your sister, what is her life like?
Now she's quiet, you know, at home because she can't work anymore and everything. But she went to school with me, and then she did the high school, and then she did the university. She graduated. She was a dentist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, when you're how old, your mother sends you to music school?
When I was 9.
Okay. Now, usually in America in this era, it's about sending your kids to take piano lessons. Okay.
Then in my case, was accordion.
Okay. But you had to learn how to read music.
Yes.
So you learned that.
Yes.
Do you still know how to read music?
Not necessarily, because I gave up. I abandoned. To have the tuitions, you know, for playing accordion and everything, it was necessary to have theoretical knowledge about music and everything and everything. And I took it. And then my first 4 or 5 years with music was playing, learning how to play accordion, and then knowing a little the theory, musical theory. Then, later, when I gave up the accordion to take the guitar, I taught myself, you know.
Okay.
Without
theory. So why the accordion?
Because it was a very, a very remarkable instrument in terms of our culture. We lived in a region where the great, great, great master of music, you know, in pop music, was a guy named Luiz Gonzaga, and his instrument was accordion.
Oh, really?
So everything we were listening in, you know, in the radio and in the houses. And,
fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, he was big. He was the big star. He was the
Did you ever go to see him perform?
Yes. Yeah. And that was an inspiration for me. That was exactly why I decided to take the accordion. After I went to an open-air concert that he gave in Salvador, Bahia. And then I said, when I got home, I said to my people, I want to play the instrument he's playing. And then my mother said, okay, I'm going to send you to school.
This is, if you were of a certain age, you're a baby boomer, and you're in your 60s, a lot of people started picking up the guitar when they saw the Beatles, okay? So you're playing the accordion. Do you ever have doubts and say, I don't really like this?
A little, yes. I because especially because of the way the school, you know, went for me. I mean, with a lot of exercise and theoretical lessons and things and the repertoire that was not necessarily
right.
You know what I wanted. I had to play many classical pieces and you know European classical pieces and everything. And that okay, I liked it because I like music, but was not the cup of tea, you know, not my cup of tea. And then when João Gilberto, that you
of course
you know who he is, he started the bossa nova playing guitar thing, you know, that was astonishing, that was absolutely, you know, amazing. And
what year did bossa nova start in Brazil?
And then I took the guitar myself.
When did bossa nova become a big sound in Brazil?
59, 60.
Yeah, okay. So it was like a year or two late in the United States.
Yeah.
That it hit there.
When they went to the Carnegie Hall.
Exactly.
Famous, legendary moment.
Was bossa nova an instant success in Brazil?
You mean now?
Yeah. In 59.
In 59? No, that was starting. That was the first record that was released, you know. João Gilberto singing, Vai Minha Tristeza, right. Chega de Saudade. And Jobim's, Tom Jobim's right. song. And then that became very popular. And then the following, you know, records and things became very big and so and so and so. And then Bossa Nova became something, you know, big right. in Brazil. And not only here, but then...
Around the world.
Around the world.
So you literally, Bossa Nova hits you to say, I'm done with the accordion, now I'm playing
the guitar. Now guitar. That was the...
Okay. But meanwhile, you're continuing to go to school.
Yes. Yes, because was the project, the family project, was that I would become a doctor.
Right, right. Like a nice Jewish boy living
first,
in Brazil.
First, my father wanted me to be a physician like himself.
Right.
And then I said, no, Papa. Impossible. And then they were starting a new school of administration, business and public administration. And then I said, I go for that. And then I went to the university to do business administration.
And you got a degree.
I got a degree four years later.
Okay.
And then because of that degree, I came to São Paulo in Rio to work as a trainee for the Unilever International
wow.
Company. You know,
okay. At that time,
as a business,
at that time, do you still believe you're going to be a professional musician?
I wanted very much. I kept that desire inside, and of course, I was looking for the opportunities to, you know, to.
Okay, at what point in your success did your parents accept that you were a successful musician and be proud of you?
After the second, third year, because I stayed as a businessman.
This is in São Paulo.
In São Paulo, you know, for 2 years, and then I started going places, knowing people, meeting musicians and everything, producing my stuff at home and everything. And then I was ready to start.
Right.
And then I wrote to my father. I phoned him, but I think I wrote to him because he had no telephone at home in the little city where he lived in Bahia. Then I wrote him a letter saying, Papa, now I'm going to do my dream. I'm going to go for my dream. I'm going to be a musician and everything. I know it's hard, but anyway, I'm going to try. And then he was a little skeptical. But then came one first song.
I have to ask you.
And then both him and my mother accepted. She accepted already because she was the one that had put the accordion and the guitar in my hands. You know, he was a little more, you know,
reticent.
Reticent.
When you quit your job and you want to be a musician, do you ask your father for money?
Yes.
What does he say?
He said, "You see, I was telling you, it's risky." you're not able to, you know, to get a living, anything. I said, yeah, Papa, but I'm gonna try. Can you help me? And he said, okay, I'll help you.
But did he put a time limit on it? Did he say, I'll help you for 2 years, back to Unilever?
No. He said, make a good use of this money that I'm sending you, you know. Provide your needs, you know. Provide your living, get well with your family, and give your try. Go for your try with music. If it doesn't succeed, we're gonna see.
You're listening to Gilberto Gil, who was excommunicated from his own country, went to London in the early 70s, was influenced by reggae, came back to Brazil, had a huge hit with a cover of No Woman, No Cry. We'll be back in a moment. Hey, it's Bob, and I host the Bob Lefsetz podcast on TuneIn. Each week, I welcome innovators from the worlds of music, tech, and media to join me in the TuneIn studios. From Shirley Manson, lead singer of the band Garbage, to Nathan Hubbard, the former CEO of Ticketmaster and stealth innovator in the ticketing space. We discuss their backgrounds as a means to understand how and why they became successful, leaving an impact on the world as we know it. Check out the Bob Lefsetz podcast on TuneIn. And now back to more with Gilberto Gil on the Bob Lefsetz podcast. So you quit your job at Unilever before you were successful at music.
Yeah, yeah.
So how long after you quit did it start to work?
2 to 3 years, between 2 to 3 years.
What was the key to making it work?
It was the success of a song in a context that we had then in a big television network, you know, presenting artists, new artists doing new songs, you know, and everything. And one of those songs became a very successful.
Now, you wrote
one.
The song.
I wrote the song and I performed
it,
the song.
And you were on the television
on
show.
On the television
How did you
show.
Get on the television show?
I was asked to.
So you didn't have a manager, you were just doing it yourself.
I was asked. When I was in the Unilever job, and as I told you, I started going places and seeing people, meeting musicians. Some of those musicians, some of those artists were already, you know, big
successful.
Ones. Successful. And one of them, Elis Regina, a big, big singer, a female singer, very important. I was sent to her house someday to show her some songs because she was going to record the next
right,
album.
Right, she needed songs.
You know? And then she said, okay, I will take you to my show, to my television show. And so she did.
Okay, it worked out that. I have to ask, you got your degree in business administration.
Mm-hmm.
Did it help you at all in your music career?
I think so. Especially in terms of the running, the administrating of my career. Because at first in São Paulo, I took somebody as an agent to take care of myself and of my bookings and things, you know, and my relating to the media and so and so and so. But then, with the experience I had, not that necessarily the experience, but with the knowledge, you know, that had about business and everything that had acquired at the university, I told myself, okay, I think I can go by myself, you know, running my own
wow.
thing. And then I did. And I started my own small company, and it's been so like that, you know.
Okay, so for almost 50 years,
yeah.
You never had a manager?
No, yeah. Not.
You're the manager for
yeah,
50
I've
years.
I've been for.
Wow. But you had... Did you, in terms of a booking
of
agent?
Course, of course, I have a group. I have a team.
Of course, you're not doing it yourself.
I have a team. I have my wife, for instance, that takes care of the whole, you know, office thing and everything. But the last word is my word.
And in terms of booking gigs, you also do that in house?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Our office, it's a compound that includes the running of the career, the booking of the career, the relating with the press and everything, the studio where we are now here, also where I rehearse, I record, and everything. It's been like that for for a long time.
Wow. Because most musicians from that era can tell stories of getting ripped off by management, accountants. I guess if you're ripped off, you only have to blame yourself.
It was not necessarily my case.
Right.
My case was more of a natural, you know, personal impulse.
Right.
Personal need, a personal desire to give chance to the studies that I had done at the university, you know,
so
something like that.
You go on the television show, and you perform your song. What happens after that?
After that, I started to be, you know, popular. I mean, the record that came from that.
So you made a deal with a record company.
Deal with a record company. That big success was recorded. Other songs also were recorded, and I did my first album, you know, my first...
First album was what year?
1956.
Okay.
Oh, pardon, 1960.
1960. Yeah, I think in terms of that makes sense in terms of switching from accordion to guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
So you make your first album, and it's successful immediately.
In a sense, yeah, and some not huge success,
right.
But successful sufficiently to, you know, to keep a career, to you know, to
why
sustain.
Do you, right. Why do you career. Think it was successful?
Novelty, you know, the elements, the new elements that we brought in that song, you know, the subject of the song, the sounds that we provided with the guitars and with the arrangements, you know, and also the singing was a different way of singing it, you know, but it was a novelty. You know.
Well, that's very interesting because that's the way it was in the old days, whereas everything sounds just like everything else today. So is that your personality? Are you always testing limits and trying to change things and not be like everybody else?
To a certain extent, yes. I had the feeling that, you know, in this life, in this living time, we have to contribute as much as we can, you know, with things, with provocations, and with, you know, instilling different elements, you know, in especially if you talk about culture, you know, and about music, it's something very, you know, moving all the time. So whenever one guy or one girl has that kind of feeling that, you know, contribution may be given, may be possible from their work, they go in for it. And that was exactly what happened. I said, okay, I sing a little differently, I play a little differently, I have some new ideas about, you know, subjects for new songs and that kind of thing. And then I said, okay.
Now, at some point in this story, they put you in jail. What year do they put you in jail? Yeah.
Then, in 1968, the system, the political...
Okay, but before we get to 68, what happens between 62 and 68? Just more and more success?
More and more success, yeah.
Okay, and now...
To the point that we started a movement, me and Caetano Veloso and Gal Costa and some other artists, we start a movement that came to be called Tropicália, Tropicalismo. And that had, besides being musical, was also a cultural movement, enforcing the new possibilities of the new theater, of the new literature, you know, the new cinema, and that kind of thing. So it was a huge movement, and of course, it became something.
Okay,
you know,
to what?
When the dictatorship took place, you know, the military guys, you know, seized power and installed a very, very repressive system. So they went for everything that would not be, that wouldn't be, you know.
So before, but going back to specifically what you're saying, this was a very turbulent time around the world. There were student protests in France.
Yeah.
We had English music. We had race riots in the United States. Mm-hmm. To what degree were you influenced by that for the Topicalismo movement?
Of course, a lot. A lot. Music was not just music. The Beatles, I mean, the importance of the Beatles or the Stones or the Grateful Dead or whatever, you know, or the Jefferson Airplane, all those groups, you know, Bob Dylan and Jimi Hendrix. I mean, the influences of those artists were not just musical. They had a lot to do with new visions and, you know, new ways of considering society and costumes and, you know, different ways of living and supporting in somehow supporting revolutionary movements in all directions, in different directions, you know. And that, of course, was very influential on ourselves. I mean, despite the fact that we had a military regime to protest against here. But, I mean, the influence coming from outside, I mean, the new spirit coming from youth, you know.
Well, that's very well articulated. That's what people who didn't live through the era didn't know. If you wanted to know what was going on, you listened to the radio, you listened to the music. It told you everything about the culture.
Yeah, yeah.
But to what degree were the Beatles, the Stones, Jefferson Airplane, Bob Dylan, to what degree were they successful in Brazil? Very successful.
Very successful, yeah, here.
And did they ever come, any of those acts, to play live?
They were not still coming to perform in Brazil. No. The British and American groups started coming here, something that came later.
Right.
Came exactly after I was exiled in London. In London, yes, I went to see many concerts. I went to see, I remember that I went to the Lyceum to see John Lennon and Yoko Ono doing their performance, you know,
right,
for Christmas in 1970. And I went to see Bob Dylan at the Isle of Wight. I went to see Jimi Hendrix concerts. I went to at the Round House. I went to see different places in London. So that experience of being directly influenced by a contact with artists, that came after the exile.
Right. Let's go back. The government arrests you.
Yeah.
What do you think?
What I
thought then.
Wow, I was so mad, you know, on the side and so scared on the other side. I mean, I had a mix of being scared and being mad.
So did you think your career was over? Did you think you might die?
Well, first they imprisoned us. No, they jailed us.
Okay, before you do, did you know they were going to imprison you?
I was expecting.
Okay.
From the atmosphere, from the general atmosphere, and the increasing of their, you know, hard line process, you know, I had a feeling that somehow things were going to be.
Did you ever think bad of exiling yourself so you wouldn't get arrested?
Not then, not yet. No, I was keeping my work here. I was saying, okay, let us see how the situation develop, and then they came one day. They came to our place and said, okay, you're gonna.
And they take you to jail with what we say in America, the general population, with all the other criminals?
No. No, we were political prisoners.
Okay.
Yeah, political prisoners.
And they put you in a special jail?
In headquarters, in the army headquarters.
Oh, really?
Because the government was a military government.
So you're there how long before you're exiled?
How long
were you in jail before you left the country?
3 months.
And during that 3 months?
3 months in jail after they sent us to our places in a situation of home imprisonment in Bahia for 6 months, and then they said, go out of the country. And then they...
So they said, if you leave, that's okay.
If you leave it, that's okay.
Okay.
What we can't allow you is to come back, you know, to your natural situation of being a performer and
making trouble here in Brazil.
You know, talking to the public and that sort of thing, giving interviews in the press and that kind of thing. That you cannot. If you can go wherever you go, no problem. So you went to England.
Were you happy with that?
In a sense, yes, because I mean that was the way to get rid of the torch, you know.
Right. So you go to London.
Yeah.
Do you have any money?
No. Money. The family here was to collect. Was left to collect the rights. You know. The music rights that we had then, you know, had some already at that time, and send us in London. So the first, let's say, first year in London, I was living with, you know, my money coming from Brazil, from our, you know,
When you go to London, you're a star in Brazil. Does anybody know who you are in London?
Yeah.
Okay. So doors start to open.
Yeah. Doors start open.
So this is in 69?
In 69. July 69. The day I got to London was the very day the Rolling Stones were doing the Hyde Park concert.
Right after Brian Jones died.
Yes. Yes.
Where they set the doves free, etc.
I arrived in London, and I remember well coming to the airport, to the hotel we were going to be. I saw the park, I mean, the leftovers of, you know, cans and garbage and everything in one sector of the Hyde Park. And then I asked the driver, what's going on? Why, you know, that he said, oh, it's just the Rolling Stones concert that happened, you know, that ended, you know, that was finished like 2 or 3 hours ago.
So you land in London. How do you penetrate and get involved with the music scene there?
First, in terms of recording, the possibilities of recording and everything, our company here, the Polygram, a company here, got in touch with their pals, their guys in London.
You remember who was running Polygram in London then? No.
No.
Okay. So they get in touch with the guys from Polygram.
On Polygram, that they couldn't properly they themselves, you know, take care of our stuff in London. And then they asked Famous Music, a label.
Yeah, Famous Music, part of Paramount.
Paramount.
Right.
And then Ralph Mace was in charge of Famous Music in London. And there was the guy, you know, that took us to the studio, started doing things, planned a recording, did a recording, did a release, and then I released my album in London.
So when you were there, was your intention to make music for Brazil or to make music for the rest of the world?
Mixed feelings about.
Okay.
I was, of course, I had to stand for my Brazilian, you know, character and everything. Was a Brazilian musician, recently living the country and everything. So I was a lot compromised with the Brazilian thing. But at the same time, I had a feeling that, you know, I could do an international thing. I could somehow try an international career. And I started doing it. I started going to Europe, you know, to perform in Switzerland, in France, in Germany, you know.
Now, did people already know you there? Or you felt if you played, you'd be good enough to build an audience?
No, I had to build an audience. I was not artistically, I was not knowing. Right. No. I was a little known in some circles, in some restrict circles, in Paris and London and Berlin and other places, Spain, by the fact that we were victims of the
repression in Brazil,
the dictatorship here. Yeah.
So you end up working with some famous musicians while you're in London.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. We went. One of the things that I used to do was going places to see performances, different performances from different artists. And then I got acquainted, you know, with some. I remember Jimmy Capaldi, for instance, the drummer for...
Of course, for Traffic.
He became a friend. Terry Reid.
Terry Reid. I saw Terry Reid in McCabe's like 18 months ago.
That was a real, real friend. I mean, you know, to come to my place, you know, every week, and I would go to his cottage, you know, in the countryside in England. And David Gilmour from
Pink Floyd, guitarist from Pink Floyd.
And many different pals that, you know, we were able to...
Do you think they were friends because of your winning personality or because of your music?
Musicians.
So your music opened the door.
Now,
didn't you also record with Jimmy Cliff?
That was later. That was when I got back from exile in Brazil already. Because reggae music was something that I had the contact with in
London. Yeah, it was big in London. It wasn't until about 1978 that we had the Johnny Nash, who had I Can See Clearly Now in 1972.
I Can See Clearly Now.
Right.
Rain is gone.
One of the great records of all time. But in reality, even though they kept saying, Bob Marley was signed with Blackwell, Chris Blackwell, and he was on Island, and they did.
And then Clapton recorded
I Shot the Sheriff. That was 74. Yeah. Okay, the end of 74. That was a hit, but people in America still didn't know what reggae was. Yeah. So the first album comes out.
I knew because I was.
Yeah, as I say, you were in London. But in America, we had Catch a Fire, and then they had Burn In, and then I think Rastaman Vibration. Yeah. Then they had the live album from the Lyceum in 77. But it wasn't until about 78 with Babylon by Bus that all of a sudden.
I followed all of that.
Right.
Because I was a follower of reggae already in Brazil. You know, since 1973, 74, when I came back here, I got the song No Woman No Cry. I wrote a Portuguese version for that song.
With the direct translation or new lyrics?
Direct translation.
Right.
A little adapted to the Brazilian reality.
And was it successful?
I was talking about the main points in the lyrics, yeah.
So was it successful here?
It was big.
Oh, yeah.
The biggest
I
ever done.
Really?
I ever made, yeah.
Because No Woman, No Cry, that's my favorite Bob Marley song. Never a hit in America. Everybody knows it now.
I know.
It's kind of like the Doors and Led Zeppelin. You know, they haven't made any new music for decades, but everybody knows. Okay, so you're in London till what year?
72.
In 72,
from 69 to 72.
Okay.
And then I came back to Brazil. I was allowed already.
They calmed down or the government changed?
The government, they were still military, but, you know, they started an opening of the regime.
Okay, so when you were in London...
When I was in London, I got the news. Now, probably you can come back. They're not going to put you in jail again. They're going to allow you to start a little, you know...
But can you make...
Re-establishing your career here. So if you want to come, come.
But did they also say don't make any trouble?
Some, to some...
But you're a troublemaker.
No excuse.
So when you come back, do you make trouble?
The recording of the song, No Woman, No Cry, at that time of distinction, you know, that's the word I forgot, distinction, you know, the word, you know, distinctioning the system and everything. That song contributed a lot to this opening, to this.
Okay, so you did a version of No Woman, No Cry when you were still living in London.
No,
That's when you came back.
I came back, and then I met Jimmy Cliff here for the first time. Actually, Jimmy had a great version of that song, and that was the one I heard first. I came to listen Bob Marley's version later. When I did the version,
right,
in the Portuguese version, I was based on
Jimmy Cliff's version.
Cliff's version.
Okay, so when you were in London for 3 years, did you want to come back to Brazil?
Sure. Missing the family, missing my first two daughters. You know that I had to live here with my parents, and you know.
Okay, so you come back to so. In the 3 years you are in England with the Polygram UK, you make inroads. You make inroads around the rest of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's still going up. Yeah. Then you go back to Brazil. You have an immediate hit with No Woman, No Cry.
Yes.
So you're bigger than ever.
Yeah.
What's the next step?
Next step was just to proceed, just to go on doing things, one record after, after the other, one record, and then another record, one hit here, one hit there, and everything, and then years passing also, you know, the time passing by, and of course I became established artist as I am today.
And to what degree, once you were back in Brazil, did you work in the rest of the world?
Pardon, what do you mean exactly?
Well, you're now in 1972.
How coming back?
No, after you come back to Brazil.
Yeah.
In 1972. Ah. To what degree are you working in Europe and the U.S.?
To a certain degree. Not as much as I started to work after I went to the Montreux Festival in Switzerland in 1978. Because then... I really had European doors open, you know, in a very extensive sense to my music. And then I started performing regularly in 5-6 different towns in France, 5-6 different towns in Germany, Italy, Portugal, Spain. And so I was able then, after 1978, I was able to travel for 2 months and perform every 2 days, every 2 nights, every 2 evenings in different places in Europe. And then that became a solid European career. As well as in the States, I started coming to New York to perform.
Who brought you to New York? Who brought you to the States?
The same people that brought me to Montreux. My record company people, Warner Brothers, Nesui
Erdogan.
Erdogan. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The distribution, Ahmet's brother.
He brought me to Montreux.
And he knew Claude, and he said, you got to put him on.
Yeah, sure.
And so we credit Nesui for your international career.
Sure. Absolutely. And then she said, now it's time, after Europe, now it's America. So you have to come to America. I'm going to find a promoter. I'm going to find a booking agent for you here. And then they started booking me in Washington, in Chicago, in New York, in Miami, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, and places where I still go very often, you know.
Today. Now, there are a lot of people live in America. When you first come to America, is it mostly expat Brazilians? Or is it...
Not necessarily, no. I started having audiences, you know, local audiences all over, you know,
in
Europe and in the States.
How important is
in
it,
Japan, no.
Right, how important is it to you to be successful outside Brazil?
It's always important. A musician that, you know, has music as his, you know, tool, his instrument, his element to contact, you know, to get across musical messages and not just musical messages, but messages in general. I mean, it's very important that we have an international
audience. Well, I always say the same thing. A real artist likes an audience more than money.
Yeah, that's it.
Money's secondary to the arts. But there are some...
Money's just to survive.
Right.
You know, audiences is to live.
Right. Or it's like a friend of mine booked Oprah Winfrey. You know who Oprah Winfrey is? Yes? No? Do you know who Oprah Winfrey
Oprah.
Is?
Oprah.
Okay.
We never met.
Okay,
know,
so Oprah,
but I know
Oprah ended her TV show, and she was playing arenas, and a friend of mine was booking it.
Arenas.
And they say, why does Oprah have to work? As David Letterman, you say, Oprah has all the money.
No, not
and he
money.
Says, nowhere you can get that amount of love, that hit, unless you play live. When you got 20,000 people cheering for you.
And saying it's
exactly.
still valuable, it's still worth, you know, listening to somebody like her. And it's still worth for her, you
right.
know, addressing some people.
So, but you're in Brazil, in America, generally speaking, artists are successful for 3 to 5 years. Then there's a new crop of artists. But you continue to be successful.
I come from a time in history, you know, as an artist, when and where things were a little different from, you know, as they are today. Establishing something was important, you know, not just for the artists or the record companies, but also for the public. The public, you know, liked to be, you know, to be with the ones to be standing for the ones that they.
I liked. Couldn't agree more.
You know, but public wanted that.
And do you think the public
had the space to
right.
to do that because they were not bombarded by
exactly
by new stuff, new musical bombs, and as we are today. I mean, we had time and space, the time economy.
No, I couldn't agree more.
Economy,
you know, as I say, you would be in
allowed
your
allowed us to settle.
You know? No, you bought a record, and you couldn't afford every record, and you came in your bedroom and you played that record again and again
Are
and again.
Sure?
To where it's not like today, where the whole history of recorded music is at your fingertips.
No. And with the internet, music shops and everything that you can, you know, you do your lists and,
right.
and everything. I mean, it's completely different today.
Totally different.
So, you know. They would be faithful. I mean, like the public wanted, you know, that kind of.
But do you think the public still feels that way? It's just they're bombarded.
Some, especially the older generations, they stand for that style of you know of being fans and appreciating music and everything. The new kids forget. I mean, they. They go with the tides, you know.
You're listening to the legendary Gilberto Gil, superstar in Brazil. We'll be back in a moment. Hope you're enjoying listening to this episode of the Bob Left Sense podcast. If you want to see videos and photos of our guests, go to @TuneIn on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Let's dive right back in with my guest, Gilberto Gil, on the Bob Left Sets podcast. So you end up working in the government.
For a while, yeah.
How did that come to be?
Oh, one day I was... President Lula had been elected.
So what year is this?
That was 2001.
Okay.
2000, end of 2001, 2002. And he had been elected. And one day I was on stage in São Paulo, sound checking for a concert. And then I got a call. And that was his secretary.
Had you met him previously?
Oh, sure. I had met him, sure, during the campaign.
Right.
And I had been following his career because he was a worker and he was a labor, you know, man for a while. And then he became a politician. And then he ran for president for three times and lost. And then he went a fourth time and he succeeded. He was elected. And then that day he was that call from him. From his secretary saying, President Lula, he was good to be inaugurated like 3 months later in January 2003. And then he invited me to go to Brasilia and to offer me the Minister of Culture. And then I pondered and, you know, they thought... pros and cons and that thing. And I decided to go. And I went, I stayed there for 6 years with him.
Okay, when you were the 6 years there, to what degree could you pursue music?
Of course, I could have my guitar with me whenever I went, wherever I went. And I made a deal with the government that I could perform. I could keep performing as far as I could, you know.
You had time.
Yeah, I had time for that. And then every year, we were allowed 1 month off the government job. And that I took those off.
And went on the road.
To go to the States, to Europe and everything. And here in Brazil, every weekend or whenever I wanted, at the weekends, I would go places and perform, provide that I was performing by my own, you know, costs and not performing for public...
So what did you learn working 6 years for the government?
What I learned that is very first that is very difficult. Government job is something very difficult because of many factors. First, the budget. You know, in a country like Brazil, for instance, you know, with a little tradition of really having money for, you know, for the public
right.
thing. It's very short, the money that you can have, especially if it's a minister like the one I went, you know, to run, culture, Minister of Culture. It was very little money. That was one factor that, you know, made the thing very difficult. Second, the politics themselves, you know, different parties, different people to attend, different people to satisfy, different, you know, and the huge condition of Brazil as a country, as you know, many different areas, 20 and such, and states, different states. 5,000 municipalities and it was very difficult, you know. It was, but anyway, we succeeded to do something. We did something.
So if you had to do it all over again, would you still take the job?
No.
Because?
Because it's a different moment. I am too old already.
Well, forget being, if you were the same age again, if we could go back in time.
Back in time, of course, I would accept.
Okay, so what did...
Because that was a natural impulse that I followed, you know, a natural inner thing
right.
that I followed that is still with me. I mean, I'm sticking to my nature.
So, you were famous for being the opposite of a lot of old, I don't mean that you're old, but a lot of institutional people. You were for Creative Commons. You were all about the internet. How did you come to those beliefs?
Through natural interconnecting, interchanging with life and, you know, with new technologies and, you know, with new and concepts about what is necessary to provide as a government, you know, what is the task of a government, especially in a democracy, when we can, you know, have different ideas, different people, different ways of viewing the world and everything. So the new ways of, and one thing, I, as an artist, especially in those times with, when I was, I had to sort of oppose myself to the dictatorship and everything, and the exile and everything, I learned to respect youth, to respect the new things in life. I developed a big respect for new things in life. I think that new things, you know, that come through technology, through science, through, you know, different forms of knowledge and everything, that is very important. That's what, you know, that what's pushes society
okay.
ahead.
Well,
and then I took some of those ideas and some of the projects that we had around to the government.
Okay, once a little bit slower and a little bit deeper, what made you realize you have to get into new ideas and you have to embrace the future?
What made me to? I don't know if I can recollect. In terms of memory.
Well, let me put it a different way. There are many people who love rock and roll but hate hip hop. Are you the type of person when there's a new sound you say, "Oh, I like the old sound," or you say, "Well, let me see what's going on with the new sound."
Even if I don't like, I respect the right of existing, the right of being. You know, I respect differences. This is something that I learned in life, to respect differences, you know. I am different from you, but it's not because I am different from you that I have to eliminate you.
Right. So what are you most proud of what you accomplished working for the government?
We had a project named Cultural Hotspots that we were able to spread over Brazil. That would be the calling of the communities, especially poor communities and especially very distant communities in the country, to come and participate culturally and have and start playing with computers and starting have broadband, you know, to upload and download things and everything. So the hotspots were, you know, designed to do that. And we were able to have 3,500 hotspots in Brazil in that period of 6 years. And, you know, some still doing very well, you know. They were very helpful in bringing people to do different things, to include themselves culturally, you know, to come from the very far away places, you know, and have a role in the cultural, the whole cultural thing in Brazil, in the country. And I am very proud of that project.
Okay, as we sit here, President Lula is supposed to turn himself in to go to jail.
Yeah.
What do you feel about that?
I feel so many different things. First, I feel very sorry for him and for ourselves, because it's a very interesting man that had done a very interesting job for our country. And of course, I mean, he's been trialed, you know, by justice in Brazil with some, the justice in Brazil has some arguments, you know, and they have some. After all, they have collected some reasons to put him, to send him, you know, in prison, which are very
sketchy.
Sketchish,
right.
You know. So I feel sorry for all of that. I hope that either staying in prison or getting out, he will be able to stand, you know, for his strong character as an interesting man.
It's a learning experexperience being an American in Rio, Brazil. Although we get a certain amount of news, but before I came to, I tend not to be a paranoid person, but before I came here, high-profile people in the music business said, very dangerous, don't leave the hotel without security, etc. I thought they were fearful Americans, but when I talk to people in Rio, they say it is dangerous.
Same. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so what is the future of Brazil?
I hope we're going to be able to overcome this degradation that we live now in terms of society, socially, you know, with the whole differences that we have today. I mean, the injustice, the social injustice that we've been having with bad distribution of wealth and that sort of thing. I mean, access of education, access of to health care and that kind of thing. I mean, that makes Brazil, I mean, this dangerous place that we have today, because poor people not assisted, not attended, you know. crime becomes an alternative, an easy alternative. Crime is something very, very, very strong worldwide, you know. The connecting networks, you know, the crime networks are very, very big all over, you know. So for a non-attended population, you know, crime is becomes a very easy alternative, you know, and that makes a place dangerous as we have today in Brazil, as we are today in Brazil. In other places, we have different forms of danger.
Right.
Like in your country. I mean,
right.
The things of the guns and...
Well, in my country, there's a lot of crime committed by white-collar community.
Oh, yeah.
And there's very rarely a penalty.
Yeah.
But in the UK and in the US, there's a camera everywhere. So Certainly, certainly over the past few decades, the murder rate has gone down because the economy has improved in most big cities. But if you're a blue-collar person and you do anything, they have a recording. We used to say tape. Now it's on hard drive. So, you know, it's almost like a TV show. Somebody steals it. Well, let's go to the tape. There's always a tape. But it would... It doesn't seem to be that way in Brazil. It doesn't seem to be like they have a camera everywhere.
No. We, as comparing, you know, with the States, with your country, I mean, we are under development in many various senses. You know, we have a lot to do. We have a long way to go. I mean, our foundations, our historical foundations, are very different from the ones in.
For my audience, tell me how they're different.
Oh, you had a colonizing process that was quite different from ours. You had British colonizers, you know, first, you know, coming from England to do a different thing, to prove that they could build a new society, you know, as strong or even more strong than they had the English, the British society and everything. So they had a kind of a proud, you know, a pride and that sort of thing. The colonizers that came to Brazil, they came to
rip them off.
To rip.
And that mentality remains.
That it remains.
Someone told me, a Brazilian, a driver, said that Brazilians tend to look out for themselves and say, what can I do for me? If it hurts somebody else, they're not that worried about it.
Not in some senses, but we also can be a very generous people. We can be.
So at this point...
In many, many, many different ways. We can open our houses.
Well, certainly they've opened their hearts to me, but, you know, my view is relatively limited as opposed to someone who lives here. So you mentioned to me earlier, before we were on mic, that you personally had an experience where you were robbed, your family was robbed.
Mm-hmm.
It was not recently, it was a couple of decades ago. A
couple of decades
but
ago.
But do you ever think of, because of the social, political situation in Brazil, do you ever think of moving to another country?
No. I've been to other, I was in London.
Right.
I was in England, you know, during the exile. I was spontaneously in L.A., for almost 2 years when I decided to go there, invited by Sergio Mendes to do an American record and everything, but never really thought about leaving Brazil, you know. Because I think that facing difficulties and danger and unaccepted, you know, unbearable situations, that is something that you can always have anywhere. First time I was robbed was in London. And what was it? I went to the Round Scots that you might have heard about, very famous London nightclub,
right.
Jazz.
Yes, Ronnie Scott's.
Ronnie Scott's, the sax player
exactly.
In the club. There. I went one night to see, if I'm not wrong, was Sandra.
Okay.
That was performing there.
Legendary jazz act.
Legendary Sandra. And entering the club, I was grabbed by two young guys and with a knife. And then, you know, they menaced me with a knife and everything, and they took inside my pocket, you know, their hands inside my pocket, took my wallet, took my money, run away. And that was London.
So you say it could happen anywhere.
It can happen anywhere. And that was what? They were getting money for drugs.
Right. That's a whole different topic about legalizing drugs and reducing crime. You know, we're making some progress with marijuana in America. In America, there's too many people are in jail for drugs who shouldn't be, but the federal government right now is fighting. It's a crazy situation. We don't have to talk about how crazy the United States is. But at this point in your career, are you still excited about making new music?
Yes, yes, but a little more selectively, you know?
What does that mean, more selectively? Less frequently?
Less frequently. Attending to more special requests, you know, a little more like very...
So how many live dates do you do a year now?
I do around 50.
Okay.
When I used to do 120.
And you before. Do it for the rhythm, for the emotional experience, or you do it for the money?
Mostly for the experience, for the pleasure, you know, for the nourishing of my,
okay.
of my soul.
You've been doing it a long time, and I heard this question asked of John Bon Jovi, of all people, recently. Do you remember a specific gig that was like the greatest gig for you?
Difficult one, at least two or three.
And what made those so special?
The music sometimes, I mean, the performing, properly speaking sometimes, I mean, like the delivering, the playing, the singing, the band, that kind of thing, and the audience and their reaction. But sometimes the situation in a general sense. One of these memorable performances that I have in mind that you asked me about is the one in 1969, when we had already asked to leave Brazil for the exile, and we were allowed to do a farewell concert in Bahia. And then we did, you know. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning, a Sunday.
real music time.
Real music time. And it was incredible. I mean, you know, the warmth and the, no words.
I mean, get the emotion from the way you're saying it.
To a level that it's absolutely impossible to describe in words. You know?
Now, if you're at home, you obviously are making your own music, and AC/DC famously said they didn't listen to anybody else's music, but do you listen to other people's music, and what are some of your favorite musicians or records?
I still like very much. I have some old records that, you know.
I'm old, too. You can mention they're old.
Old record by Miles Davis, for instance.
Kind of Blue.
And
Bitches Brew. And you like Bitches Brew?
Bitches Brew that I bought when I was in London. That was exactly when he released Bitches Brew, when I was arriving in
London. Well, the funny thing was, because we were talking also off mic about Fillmore East, Laura Nero, who was a client of David Geffen, she used to play at the Fillmore ultimately every Christmas. But I went to see her in June of 1970, and the opening act was Miles Davis playing Bitches Brew. Now, if you look at that record today and you look who's on it, we didn't know anything. We're sitting there waiting for Laura Nero. But I think John McLaughlin was in the band. Everybody was in the band. It was unbelievable.
The Brazilian, Arthur, the Brazilian. Percussionist.
Right. Any other records that you think of?
Oh, Jimi Hendrix records. Bob Marley's records.
Can you mention a specific Jimi Hendrix or Bob Marley record or song?
Bob, I would go Babylon by Buzz would be okay, but I think that Catch a Fire would be okay, one of the first
ones. Stir It Up.
Stir It Up, one of the things. From Jimmy, Bold as Love.
Really? If six was a nine.
Yeah, yeah. And from Miles, I have already mentioned Dylan's songs and records, and in Brazil, I mean, so many.
Right. Okay, so in the time you have left on this planet, which is not infinite because none of us are going to live forever.
No.
Any specific thing you would like to accomplish or any goals left unfulfilled?
That I haven't already?
Yes.
No big ambitions left. I mean, I think that the main targets have been, hit. And the main desires have been satisfied. And then I'm okay. The little ambition that remains is related to this day-to-day kind of, needs that we have. We have to be clean. I love to be.
You're wearing all white today.
I love.
You certainly
I
look to, clean and sound and smell
like to
clean to me.
Be clean to be, a little perfume. I like to eat. Not much. But I like the way they cook our food at home. That kind of thing. I still like to go sometimes. Go to Europe. Go to the States. Go to Japan. Go to Africa. I think that in October I'm going to India for the third time. Those things, and watching the kids growing, watching the family, becoming grown ups themselves,
establish themselves, yes,
and starting to have to deal with life problems themselves.
Right. They see how hard it was or still is.
Yeah, and that sort of thing. I mean, in a sense, I'm okay. I've been Fred,
Okay, in 1977, James Taylor put out a record called JT, switched from Warner Brothers to Columbia, and the last song on the first side was called The Secret of Life. And he said, the secret of life is enjoying the passage of time.
Yeah.
You have a lot of perspective. Any secrets of life you can inform my audience?
Just the minute to minute, hour to hour, day to day, year to year thing, It goes. And you go adapting yourself in several terms, and physically, mentally, emotionally. You go adapting to whatever life offers or imposes to you.
You've been listening to the astounding Gilberto Gil, who started talking about the impact of music beyond the actual notes on the audience in the 60s. And you can see he's still that gentleman who looks at the landscape and says, this is my perspective. And if you've been listening to this point, I know that your perspective has been widened. Thanks so much for being on the podcast, Gilberto.
I am the one to thank you and your audience.
Once again, that was Gilberto Gil. I know your head is spinning, as mine was when I was in the hills of Rio de Janeiro, listening to him talk about his life, his politics, even being in the government of Brazil. Till next time, it's the Bob Lefsetz Podcast.